Here on FM, our Book of the Week. In 2006, Peter Pomerantsev, the son of political exiles, moved to Moscow to work in the fast-growing television and film industry. Telling the stories of the subjects of his TV programmes, he traces the transformation of modern Russia from communist collapse to postmodern dictatorship. Justin Salinger reads, "Nothing is true and everything is possible."
I'm in a meeting at TNT when my phone goes off. "Peter, it's Vitaly Jomachka. I need you to do me a favour. Will you do me a small favour?" Vitaly has a way of asking that makes it uncomfortable to say no. "Sure. Come to D station. Bring a camera. And not a little one, a real one. Deal?" "Sure." The journey will take an hour on one of the slow suburban trains. These trains are among the most miserable rides in Russia, full of the angry poor of satellite towns, the shop assistants and cops and cleaners who come every day to the big city to be within breathing distance of all the platinum watches and Porsches, only to be blown back again each evening to their dark peripheries, carrying their shift clothes, crumpled in plastic bags, drinking lukewarm beer in a cold train. I wonder what Vitaly could possibly be doing in D, but it has been a while since I last heard from him. Once upon a time, Vitaly Jomachka was a gangster. In the 1990s, the words Russian and gangster became almost synonymous, but when the president ascended to the Kremlin, the era of the gangster ended. The secret services took over organized crime themselves. There was no way hoodlums could compete. Some became Duma deputies to make their money safe, while others retired to become regular businessmen. But in Siberia, Vitaly Jomachka had other plans. He wanted to direct movies. He gathered his crew. No more Grand Theft Auto and extorting businessmen, he told them. They were going to make films about themselves, starring themselves. None of them knew anything about filmmaking. They had never heard of montage, storyboards or camera movements. There was no film school they could go to, no famous director to guide them. Vitaly worked out how to make movies himself. He watched and re-watched the classics, breaking down every shot, every cut, every twist and turn in the plot. There was no script on paper. Scripts were for saps. Everyone knew the scenes from memory. They didn't use makeup or stuntmen. They jumped from tall buildings themselves and crashed their own cars. All the blood you saw on screen was real. When there wasn't enough from a wound, Vitaly would stab a syringe in his own vein and spray the contents all over himself. The guns and bullets were all real too. When they filmed a shoot-'em-up in a bar, the place was wasted. The result was an epic 6-hour miniseries, The Specialist. And when it was ready, the gangster auteurs had their own ideas about managing distribution. They would walk into local TV stations with a copy of the series and tell the managers to show it, or else. No one argued. The sound was all over the place, and some of the shots didn't match, but overall Vitaly had cracked it. There was plot, action, drive. It was a sensation. He became a Siberian star. When I first met Vitaly, he was at the height of his fame and had come to Moscow to appear on talk shows and look for money for his next big film about his early days. I was working as an assistant to an American documentary director, and we were trying to persuade Vitaly to let us make a documentary about him. Tall and lean and shaven-headed, Vitaly looked uncannily like the president's meaner, taller twin. He wore a designer tracksuit, pressed flat. He drank cappuccinos. "Did you always want to be a gangster?" we asked. "I always knew I could be more than other people. Run faster, jump higher, shoot better. Just more." Everything about him seemed so contained. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, and told me off for swearing. "What made you want to make movies?" "I'd spent 8 years in jail. You watch a lot of TV in jail. There were all these cops and robber shows. They were showing my life, my world, but it was all fake. The fights were fake, the guns were fake, the crimes were fake. What can an actor know about being a gangster? Nothing. Only I could tell my story. Vitali's TV miniseries showed his life of crime in scrupulous detail. In his violent pomp, he had been a modern Dick Turpin, a real highwayman. He would hide in the bushes by the side of the motorway, waiting for a trailer load of brand new Mitsubishis or Toyotas just brought in from Japan. Then he would pull a kerchief over his face, draw out his sawn-off shotgun, and walk out into the middle of the highway. He would stand, legs apart, gun pointed out from his hips, alone in the middle of the road, facing down the oncoming truck. They always stopped, and all the cars were his. If the driver struggled, Vitali would beat him up. The TV series revelled in these moments of violence. But what about your victims? Did you ever feel sorry for them? Of course not. No one who does what I do feels sorry for the victim. You're either a dope or a real man, and dopes deserve all they get. The central scene of The Specialist involved Vitali killing another mob boss. In the film, he calmly walks up and shoots his rival, then calmly walks away again. The whole thing happened so fast, I had to rewind and replay to double-check what had happened. Can anyone be a killer? No. When I was in prison, there were men who regretted what they'd done. They wept, went to church. Not everyone has the inner strength to do it, but I do. And would you ever return to crime? Vitali smiled. Nowadays, my life is all about art. We persuaded him to take us down to his hometown, north of Vladivostok, close to the Chinese border, and let us film him shooting a scene for his next project. We'd have an exclusive with the gangster director at work, and he'd have a promo to help raise money. Usually you'd be one of my victims, he said, matter-of-factly. But in this case, we'll be partners. The town was clean, quiet. Us gangsters keep this town disciplined, said Vitali. There used to be druggies, prostitutes. They wouldn't dare show their faces now. We showed them who's boss. I don't even let anyone in my crew smoke cigarettes. Vitali was a celebrity here. When we paused by a school, the kids saw him through the window and came running out, mobbing Vitali and thrusting forward their maths books and homework pads for him to sign, the teachers smiling benignly. Prison was Vitali's alma mater. This part of Siberia was full of them. Everywhere you looked were barbed wire, watchtowers and concrete walls. We shot an interview with Vitali as he gazed towards where he had first served time. Everything I learned was there, he said. Vitali had first gone inside in 1988. When he came out in 1993, the whole universe he had grown up in was transformed. The Soviet Union had disappeared. Everyone who had previously been someone was suddenly a nobody. The teachers and cops and judges went unpaid. The factory workers were making fridges and train parts no one needed. The war heroes were penniless pensioners. When he had been first put away, men like Vitali had been destined for a life on the margins. They were Spanner, scum. Now, suddenly, he sensed this was his era. The only values were cars and cash. The gangsters could access these things the fastest, with the most direct methods. But they didn't just extort and steal. Businessmen called them in to guarantee deals. If one partner reneged, the gangsters would sort him out. People turned to them instead of the uninterested police to catch rapists and thieves. They became the establishment. In this new world, no one knew quite how to behave. All the old Soviet role models had been made redundant, and the West was just a story far away. But the gangsters had their own prison code, which had survived perestroika, and this made the gangsters more than just feared bullies. They were the only people in this lost new Russia who knew who on earth they were and what they stood for. And now, in the 21st century, although many gangsters are out of a job, their way of behaving has become ubiquitous. On the day of his big shoot, Vitali took over a whole market. The scene had the young Vitali and his gang being busted as they extorted money from the market traders. The traders played themselves, and cops had been hired to play cops. "Isn't there a problem that you're working for a gangster today?" we asked the cops. They laughed. "Who do you think we work for anyway?" Vitali's set had a cast of hundreds, and it should have been chaos. But I'd never seen a film set so slickly run. His gangster crew was the production team. Who would dare to be late on set when professional killers are running the show? Vitali was a natural, cap pulled low, long finger tapping against his mouth. He set up every camera position unerringly. Though there was no script on paper, he never got lost, giving terse, tight instructions to all the players. "It's just like setting up a heist," he told me. "Everything's got to be exact, not like one of your little documentaries." That was the last time I had seen him, 3 years before. Vitali was at the train station to meet me. He was wearing his usual ironed tracksuit. It had been a while since I'd seen anybody wear one. He greeted me warmly. I sensed he was genuinely glad to see someone from the old days. "Thanks for coming," he said. "You live here now?" I asked. "I'm lying low. I avoid Moscow. Too many cops wanting to check your documents. Everyone back home has been put away, the last of my crew. I wouldn't have anyone to film with even if I could raise the money." It turned out Vitali wanted me to shoot a short interview with him. He was planning a documentary about himself. Then Vitali shot an interview with me. He had all my words written out already. I just had to memorise the script. The first time I met Vitali, he struck me as the most talented, dangerous man, and the most dangerous, talented man I had ever encountered. It was a long speech, and I kept on fluffing my lines, but Vitali was a patient director, and by the fifth take, we'd got it right. After the shoot, Vitali leaned into the back and brought out a pile of hardcover books. "These are for you." They were novels written by Vitali. "I've taken to writing books. They're selling pretty well. I'll be honest, the first one was ghostwritten, but since then I've learned how to write myself. If I can't film, I'll write. And you know what the future is, Peter? Comedy. Set up a meeting for me at TNT. I told Vitali I'd do my best. A few weeks later, I walked into TNT and there was Vitali, sitting in one of the little glass meeting rooms with a couple of producers, wearing his shell suit and cap. "Is he for real?" the women in the drama department asked me afterwards. "Oh, he's quite real," I said. "You interested in his book?" "It's well written. We need to think about it." When I tried to follow up on the meeting with Vitali, he had disappeared. He was lying low again, but I guess he's okay. Every year I see a new novel of his on the pulp fiction shelves in bookshops. Most of them comedies.
Justin Salinger reading Nothing is True and Everything is Possible by Peter Pomerantsev. The producer is Kirstine Cameron.
70 years since the liberation of Auschwitz, Michael Rosen marks Holocaust Memorial Day.
Hidden in the secret annex in the house in Amsterdam, Anne Frank could see a horse chestnut tree which grew in the gardens below. She wrote that she couldn't be unhappy when she looked at the tree.
Anne Frank's trees. Keeping the memory alive.
It is our responsibility to acquire the memories of survivors and to pass those memories on.
I'm 84 and I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to do this. Who will do it when we are gone?
This morning at 11 and then on the BBC Radio 4 website.